All right, y'all, Scott Horton here, and I got a great deal for you. Anyone who helps support this show with a $50 donation or more gets a copy of the brand new Rothbard book, Murray N. Rothbard book, of long-lost essays from 1967 and 68. It's entitled Never a Dull Moment, A Libertarian Looks at the 60s. Murray N. Rothbard, really Mr. Libertarian himself, on Vietnam, conscription, civil rights, LBJ and Nixon, and all kinds of great stuff from back during those times. Never a Dull Moment, and it's an exclusive. It's not available on Amazon yet. It's an exclusive, so far at least, for listeners of this show, so be the first to get it. Help support this show at the same time. Just go to scotthorton.org/donate, and again, anyone who sends $50 on this way, along with a mailing address, and I will get this book right to you. Thanks. All right, y'all. Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much for tuning in. Check out the archives at libertarianinstitute.com/Scott Horton Show and sign up for the podcast feed there as well. And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Introducing Sandy Tolan. He's a regular for Tom Dispatch. He's the author of The Lemon Tree and Children of the Stone about music schools established under the military occupation, the Israeli military occupation in the West Bank. He's reported from more than 35 countries, is a professor at the Annenberg School for Journalism and Communication at USC. Go Bruins. His website is...
It's the Trojans, pal.
Yeah, I know. His website is sandytolan.com.
Okay.
Honestly, you know what? I'm a Texan, but I'm born and raised a Bruin, so I have to pick a fight.
Okay. All right.
I do the same thing to Mohamed Sahimi, and I absolutely love that guy. But you know him? You ever hang out with him? The Iran expert?
No, I don't know him.
Oh, man. He's great. Chemical engineering department there.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, yeah. Me and my USC friends. My dad would kill me if he knew. Okay. So anyway, listen, you got this great article here, Sandy. Welcome to the show. Did I say welcome to the show? How are you?
Well, thank you, Scott. It's good to be here.
Very happy to have you back on the show. And you wrote this thing and I really hate it. I mean, it's good work. I hope everyone will read it, but it is what it is. And that's the problem. It's, throwing in the towel, the death of the two state solution. And I think, you know, I know a lot of people would argue that this has really been a long time coming, that the sooner everybody concedes this, the better. On the other hand, nobody really seems to have a very nice idea of what real annexation and one state policy might look like other than another war or something. I really don't know. But I guess so the question, if I can put this in question form, is it, first of all, I guess never mind whether it's the right thing or not, but just in terms of most people have thought so. It's been American policy. Is it too late for even a compliant Israeli government to force the settlers out of the West Bank, or enough of them anyway, with land swaps and this and that, that the people of the West Bank could have their little rump Palestinian state there? Are we already just way too past that point?
Well, in practical, political, and most other terms, Scott, I think we've long passed the point of no return on the two-state solution that would have any, you know, political or sovereign meaning for Palestinians. I mean, it's physically possible to force the, you know, more than 400,000 West Bank settlers, or a large portion of those with land swaps, as well as many of the residents of 17 or so East Jerusalem settlements. And, you know, it's not physically impossible to move those hundreds of thousands of people, several hundred thousand of those settlers, which, you know, together add up to more than 500,000 people, back to the Israeli side and the other side of the so-called Green Line, and allow the Palestinians to have a viable, contiguous, sovereign state. But in practical terms and political terms, the U.S. has basically acquiesced to a series of predominantly right-wing Israeli administrations, mostly, of course, those of Benjamin Netanyahu, and also Ariel Sharon before that, although even some of the other people who were in power as well, including Ehud Barak, were actually not champions of a two-state solution. We can talk about that. But, I mean, in practical terms, you have there is just so much, not only the military occupation and the military surveillance towers and the Jeep patrols and the flying checkpoints and the hundreds of checkpoints and other barriers, but it's everywhere you look, there's settlements on hilltops. And the Israelis have been pursuing this very hard while giving lip service to a peace deal, while undermining it by colonizing the West Bank, and in fact giving numerous tax incentives to Israelis to move out there. It's not just the religious fanatics that are, you know, although there are plenty of those as well, but these are middle class sort of suburban types who travel on these bypass roads that are very sleek, well paved roads, and they just go in and out, and they're basically creating a kind of greater Israel in the West Bank. And this has been done with the acquiescence of the United States. And we can get into that, you know, but on the one hand, the U.S. is sort of calling for a peace process. On the other hand, President Obama just signed a $38 billion 10-year deal, a record deal for foreign aid in the history of the United States with Israel, while, you know, tisking them on settlement building. You know, it's a completely schizophrenic policy the United States has.
Yeah. Yeah, that Barack Obama, he's fixing to get real mad. They don't stop.
I know. Let's wag our fingers at Israel. Meanwhile, talk about what a great friend they are and give them $38 billion, $3.8 billion a year for the next 10 years just in military aid. These go for fighter jets, you know, and all kinds of other hardware. We can get into the specifics if you like, but it's quite alarming and quite hypocritical of the United States. And actually, it's not like one hand, you know, it's the one hand is doing something and the other hand doesn't know and is doing something else. This is actually a coordinated policy, and the U.S. is well aware of what it's doing. The peace deal, the whole peace process has been a bit of a fig leaf. And as Hillary Clinton herself said in these leaked emails that have been coming out through WikiLeaks, she referred to a Potemkin peace process, in other words, a fake one, mm-hmm. a facade, as being better than nothing. So, you know, they know, the U.S. has known for a while that this is basically a meaningless process. And meanwhile, they're not exactly looking the other way, but they're not making Israel pay at all. There are virtually no consequences for the settlement building, which has basically destroyed the very solution the U.S. professes to endorse.
Yeah. Boy, and you know that line, too, about the Potemkin peace process. If you could just turn down the volume on every other scandal for a minute, isn't that the hugest, biggest, crazy, freaking thing in the whole wide world? We've been working, supposedly, on this Oslo thing since, what, 1992 or 4 or whatever it was?
93, they signed the deal on the White House loan, Arafat.
93, yeah. And, you know, I mean, critics have always been quoted as saying, you know, hey, this is fake. It's not going anywhere. Just look at it in practice. But then to hear it out of the horse's mouth, so to speak, the former Secretary of State running for president, former president's wife, after all, to just say, yeah, that's what we like to do is pretend that there's this thing called the peace process, but it's really no such thing. We're simply aiding and abetting the powerful stealing land from the powerless. Ha ha ha. And it's not even a story. Nobody even cares.
Yeah, I mean, hasn't been much. I mean, Forward, the national Jewish newspaper in the U.S. Published something from Haaretz. Mondo Weiss, which is a really excellent site, published something as well. But, you know, here's Hillary Clinton back in March of this year, writing, to her senior advisors a few days after the Israeli elections that she believed a Potemkin peace process, you know, in other words, only for show, was better than none at all. So, you know, it's basically,
better for who?
Has no clothes. We knew the emperor was naked, but now the emperor is actually Instagrammed a photo of, of the emperor's nakedness.
Yeah. Well, I hate to feel sorry for Barack Obama at all, but can you imagine running for president? You're about to win, and then the economy crashes because it was a big fake, Federal Reserve, easy money, bubble economy anyway. And then right as you're getting elected, so is Benjamin Netanyahu is coming back to power in Israel, and he's going to be the prime minister your entire presidency long. I mean, that has got to be the most frustrating thing, and especially because Netanyahu wears his contempt for the darker races right on his sleeve, treats Barack Obama like he'd be lucky to be his butler or something like that, when Obama's the emperor of the world and has to take that kind of crap from some pissant governor of some little bitty, Maryland-sized country over in the Mediterranean all day. Remember, they caught him on an open mic telling the president of France, "You think you hate him? I got to deal with him every day."
Right.
But I'm thinking, he could have did.
That was a hot mic that he knew was hot or not.
Well, I was too young at the time. I've only read the history of this. They didn't make enough of a big deal about it on TV at the time. But didn't George H.W. Bush and James Baker basically outright, in English, declare that they would really prefer it if the people of Israel would get rid of Yitzhak Shamir for them? And then they did. Couldn't he have done that and just told the people of Israel, like, "Hey, we have a real chance here, but your prime minister, as you well know, is humanity's greatest enemy. So maybe if you could get him out of the way for us, we could make a little bit of progress here."
Well, you raise a really interesting point, Scott, because it's so ironic, and in a way, one can see the failings, the deep failings, the sort of catastrophic inefficacy of the Oslo process, which began in 1993. You can understand it by realizing that the last time a U.S. leader, president or secretary of state, directly, publicly challenged Israel by threatening to withhold funds unless it stopped building settlements was before the Oslo process started. It was, in fact, James Baker, the Secretary of State under the first President Bush, who basically said, Mr. Shamir has got to stop, Yitzhak Shamir, then the Prime Minister of Israel, has got to stop building if he wants these loan guarantees. And then he basically he said, it's up to Mr. Shamir. He has my phone number. It's the famous quote from Baker. Now, can you imagine Obama or Clinton, who's, we can get into Clinton's connections to the Israeli-American tycoon Haim Saban, who's donated millions to the Clinton Foundation and Hillary's PAC and her candidacy, her campaign. But you imagine Clinton or Kerry or Obama saying anything like that. It just shows that the power of the Israel lobby has gotten so much more potent. I mean, it's not infallible. The defeat of the Iran deal, the defeat of their opposition to the Iran deal, AIPAC in particular, is significant, I think, to show that they're not infallible. But it's like nobody would ever consider saying anything like that now, because of the feared consequences. I frankly think things are changing and that the political elite doesn't realize how much is changing. I mean, if you look at polls, young Americans, including young Jewish Americans, they're not all in on Israel's behavior. They don't consider themselves as the American young American Jews as Zionist as their parents and grandparents generally do. And so I think things are changing. They're changing from the grassroots. They're not changing at the top, because you see, Hillary basically endorsing a sham peace process. And meanwhile, we could talk a little bit about the consequences to the Palestinians, which are horrendous.
Yeah, well, and that's really what I want to get to. I want to get back to Haim Saban later, actually, because I think that is a very important story. And there's some recent news along those lines that I thought was pretty funny too. But
yeah,
this is really the thing I wanted to ask you back when, but spaced out and asked you something else instead. This is the thing that I sort of kind of don't understand. I mean, I guess I understand it, but it kind of seems to me like the Israeli right doesn't really have a plan here. Because, Ehud Barak, I guess, puts it best and is the best to quote on it, the former prime minister and former defense minister under Netanyahu himself, who says, listen, we got to give them their own state, or we got to give them equal rights, or we're going to live in an apartheid system that we won't be able to maintain in, you know, the international system and whatever. It'll be just too problematic. And at the point when everyone basically just concedes that they've already de facto annexed the West Bank and it already just is apartheid, and it's nothing but a Potemkin peace process, and basically the West Bank is stolen, and it already is. Well, there's still millions of people there. And even in 67, there was too much political pressure to push them all into the Jordan River or march them all into the Sinai Desert or something like that, and do another Nakba Junior or something like that. They can't do it. They couldn't even do it then. They apparently couldn't. I guess the Americans would stop them if they tried to do it now. People have told me, many different experts have told me, nah, that's never going to happen. Well, what the hell are they going to do? Because they really have painted themselves into a corner, so to speak, here, where they have no other choices, right? They can't back out now. As you said, physically they could, but politically speaking, they're not going to remove all those right-wing settlers from the West Bank and bring them back to, you know, inside the Green Line. And they can't Nakba everybody the hell away, and yet they can't have an outright South African unapologetic apartheid system for decades into the future, because then somebody's going to BDS their ass, right? Like, so what is there a plan? I must be missing something, right?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, shockingly, people on the Israeli right and their neocon backers here in the United States don't see this the way that you and I may see it. Scott, they see this as, you know, the land, many of them see this as the land God gave, Eretz Yisrael. In other words, all of the land between the river and the sea, according to this view, you know, and it's both a strategic view as well as for some, a religious view, all of this land between the so-called river and sea, in other words, all of the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean is Eretz Yisrael. In other words, it belongs to all of us. And therefore, you know, we have the right to have it, to occupy it, and their view is not, there's not an occupation. We are returning to our lands. And so that's the mentality. That also sets up a sort of a strategic plan. One of the things I wrote about in this piece from Tom Dispatch that you mentioned, generously, by the way, thank you, is that this is really the culmination, in a sense. Where we are now is the culmination of a vision laid out by, people who moved into key positions in the George W. Bush administration, after Bush was elected in 2000. But in 1996, when Netanyahu was beginning his first term, these people, including Richard Perle, David Wormser, Douglas Faith, these are people who later became important advisors and officials in the Bush administration, laid out a vision for basically rejecting the notion of Oslo's idea of land for peace, or giving up territory in order to have a peace deal. The Palestinians essentially agreed to this. I mean, this was a huge compromise from the standpoint of Yasser Arafat and the Palestinians to agree to give up their dream of all Palestine, to have everybody living together. They agreed to a state on 22% of the land. That's the West Bank and Gaza. But Israel, you know, in principle gave lip service to that, but never really agreed to it and continued to colonize the land. That was the vision of the neocons and the Israeli right. So they don't see it. They just see it as, hey, we have to manage the occupation. Again, many don't even call it the occupation from the right. But this is our land. You know, we have people who are trying to be restive on our land, but it's ours. And that's the view. So, like, Ehud Barak correctly identified the question, you know, as, you know, you can either have a democracy or you can have a Jewish state, but if you don't divide it and give Palestinians their own sovereign state, you can't have both. If you have a Jewish state in all the land, it's apartheid. And as you point out, Scott, we're already there.
Hey, Al Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow. And thanks, y'all.
Right. Well, so then, I guess the part that I really screwed up was the idea that, and where Ehud Barak screwed up, was the idea that the world won't stand for this. I mean, maybe the world won't, but the USA will, and so the rest of the world can bite me, right? That's basically the law.
Yeah, I mean, that's where we are at this moment, Scott. But I honestly, you know, maybe this is part of what keeps anybody who writes about this, and including Palestinians, perhaps just their, you know, whatever their line of work is or whoever they may be, keeps people going, which is it just, you know, it can't stand forever. I mean, Jim Crow fell, apartheid fell, and these are, despite the vociferous objections of the Israel can do no wrong crowd, these are apt comparisons to what's the reality on the ground right now in Palestine, in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. This is the status quo, and I just don't believe it can last forever. It's going on now, but I remember years ago when I was in Gaza, way before it fell to Hamas, and it was soon after the beginning of the Oslo process. And I interviewed a guy named Issa Shawa, I believe his name, and he was from a prominent Gaza family. A lot of them had been officials and mayors of Gaza and so on. And he asked me, does Israel think America will always protect them, always give them arms, and that they will always be the biggest power in the Middle East? Do they really expect they can maintain this hold on us forever? And that's, I think, you know, where we are at. You know, that's, we're still in that place where America thinks it's always going to be a superpower. Israel is gambling that it will be so, and then taking as much land as it possibly can. But meanwhile sliming the non-violent resistance and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement as some sort of anti-Semitic threat, you know, what does, and this is one of the things that Hillary Clinton, at the behest of one of her biggest donors, Haim Saban, has, the Israeli-American whose main claim to fame is the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers franchise. And he's basically put in millions to her campaign, to the Clinton Foundation, to the Democratic National Committee. I mean, at his behest, Hillary Clinton is sliming and attacking BDS as being anti-Semitic. Does she prefer rockets? You know, does she prefer suicide bombers? What is this? I mean, do they just want Palestinians to surrender?
Yeah, or, you know, even better would be if they would just go drown themselves or, you know, just somehow go away, or really even better, just stay not real people, just kind of be a figment of Republicans and Democrats' imagination so that they don't really have to deal with what's happening here, right? We'll just put it off and put it off. Let it be. We'll have a little peace process, but it'll be a Potemkin thing. I love that that's her words. I'll never forget that.
It's pretty useful for us who write about this issue.
Yeah. Well, and so look, here's the thing too, man, is that for people who, for regular folk, right? Not people who, like you and me, do nothing but read all day, every day about all these kinds of things and whatever we can to learn. But regular people, they may not even be able to picture a map of Israel from a bird's eye view very well. Maybe sorta, kinda. And they really don't know much about the West Bank. And if, They don't see like a lot of, or Gaza for that matter, they don't see a lot of pictures and footage from the ground level of the Palestinian people being Palestinians and that kind of thing. And, you know, probably if they picture an Arab at all, they're picturing some ISIS guy in a ninja mask and an AK-47 waving it over his head or this kind of thing is the image from the media. So my question to you, Sandy, is just how human are these Palestinians anyway?
Well, you know, I've spent 20 years traveling to Palestine, to Israel as well, to Jerusalem and across the Holy Land. And, you know, honestly, when I go to the West Bank, I feel so at home. I feel so, even though my Arabic is terrible, I really don't speak Arabic. You know, a couple hundred words, I guess, but the welcoming spirit, I mean, Palestinian hospitality, for those who have experienced it, for the thousands of outsiders who have experienced, is famous. You know, just people taking you in and welcoming you, and you know, you walk down the street in Ramallah, for example. And this has happened to me a number of occasions, and I get lost. You know, you're a traveler, you're a journalist trying to figure out where some office or street is, and you ask somebody, and he's like walking in the other direction, and he goes, oh, do you know? He will take you by the hand and turn around and walk you by the hand and point until he knows that you know where you're going. I mean, one time, just another story. One time I tore a calf muscle, or I strained a calf muscle badly doing exercises in Jerusalem. And I had to take a little minibus up to Ramallah that day to start renting this flat where I was working on my book, Children of the Stone. And I was going to be based there for a few weeks. And I had such a bad limp that I was like limping up from the bus station to this flat. And the whole family was waiting for me and saw me coming. And they like immediately came out. One of them happened to be a doctor. He goes to talk to another doctor who's a specialist. It was a Saturday afternoon. They got me an appointment right away. Meanwhile, the family went out and shopped for me because I could barely walk. And I come back from the doctor healed with groceries in my kitchen. I mean, and this, you know, when you tell Palestinians about that, they'll smile and say, yes, yes, that's who we are. I mean, the welcoming spirit, you know, obviously there's a lot of sadness, a lot of rage, a lot of tension. I mean, I don't mean to romanticize an entire people, but the welcoming that I've had and the, you know, the friendships that I have among Palestinians are deep and profound. I mean, The guy I wrote this book about, Ramzi Abu Ridwan, is a musician who started these music schools, a Palestinian musician. You know, we just went on tour with the book and his music and his French Arabic ensemble. We were on the East Coast. We're going to do a West Coast tour next year in the spring. And, you know, Ramzi's become a friend. Is, you know, my wife and I went and stayed with his wife and Ramzi and his wife and their two little boys, when I presented my book in Jerusalem and Ramallah. And, you know, the sense, and then there's the children. I mean, the kids who have such dreams and such spirit and such sense of like wanting freedom. I mean, the universal sense that you have among Palestinians, more than anything else is they want freedom.
Hmm. Well, yeah, you know, I think there's a real problem here too in just, and I don't know what we can ever do to change this now, where the whole dang terror war is, so mixed up in all the TV and political power narratives with Islam and Arabs in general and this kind of thing that, you know, people think even, I mean, all kinds of people, it's just a matter of, it's sort of like you fear what you don't understand. You also just kind of assume the worst about those who you don't know, kind of a thing where, you know, to say that Arabs of any place in any description want freedom, that sounds laughable to people. Nuh-uh, they all want Sharia law. They all just want to, you know, they want power for themselves, not for the other people, this or that, but want to be free to live their own life and raise their own kids and tend their own crops and just try to be a person just like everybody else in the world. That's not true. We all know that they all have telepathy with each other and they're all in on the big Islamo-fascist plot to hate and kill all Jews and white North American Christians and whatever, this kind of thing. And all these narratives, all these, basically these TV, you know, partial truths and wholesale lies are so built up that, you know, to hear you talk about, yeah, you know, these Palestinians that like to sit around playing violins together where it's like, huh? What is he even talking about? Right? Nobody's ever heard of such a thing before.
Right.
They don't ever let us see that.
Yeah, and you know, I guess a lot of what I've been trying to do with this new book, Children of the Stone, and also just, I mean, the sort of what I've tried to do throughout my career, which is now 35-year-old career, going back to the early 80s, is just try to find stories that you know, that sort of turn our perceptions on their heads and show people as human. And it's as true with the Palestinian issue as anything I've ever encountered. And I mean, my view of this general tragedy between Israel and Palestine is that we have to change the conversation. We have to change the narrative to bring in the humanity of all the people, not just, you know, not to demonize Israelis either and you know, and foment, you know, this notion that they're all that some people have that they're not human. But in the last 5 years, my focus has been on an occupied people, because I think that's the thing that's least understood and least acknowledged in our culture and in our press. Is who are these people? Who are these children? What is it like to be a kid learning music under a military occupation? And that's what I spent 5 years doing in this book, because I felt like, you know, that could be at least my own modest contribution to changing the conversation and seeing the occupation as one of the very, very biggest and most tragic obstacles to solving this whole mess.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure you saw this too, that back in the 2014 war, I guess it just wasn't like this in 2012, not quite as much, but 2014 was the real breakthrough where there were enough Palestinians, enough Gazans on Twitter with at least 3G phones. I guess Israel finally let them have 3G. And so they were able to take pictures of the devastation and do first-person reporting from Palestine in real time on Twitter. And it was, you know, the battle of the hashtags and this and that. And the way I remember, I'm sorry I don't have a lot of footnotes offhand or whatever, but the way I remember it was American opinion on the war and who was the victim and who was the aggressor and this kind of thing in the polls shifted quite a bit for the first time in a long time. And it was because we didn't have to rely on NBC or the rest of TV to tell us what was going on. People were looking on Facebook and Twitter, and it was just, it's hard to pretend that a few bottle rockets going over the wall have, you know, compare in any way to the kind of, you know, F-16 onslaught that the Israelis were delivering on the Palestinians. And then that created a lot of pressure on the regular media, to actually include a little bit more of the Palestinian side than they normally would. So I think, you know, that's the kind of thing where hopefully technology is going to help to bring about those kind of changes too, as you say, changing the conversation, changing the frame of reference of what we're talking about. Is Gaza an armed compound of Hamas terrorists, or is it a place where the majority of the population are actually minors and they're held prisoner by the Israelis' trustees, Hamas, the terrorists, you know, this kind of thing, or whatever it is, just how unfair the fight is. People who don't even have handguns up against, first world army, you know, locked basically in concentration camps, and can't flee in any direction and this kind of thing. TV was never going to tell the American people about that. But Twitter will, and they haven't figured out a way to quite filter all that out yet. Maybe that's coming, but it seems right. Like that's the kind of thing, like along the lines of what you're saying, is saying, hey, everybody, look at these kids. Look at this, conflict from a different perspective here for a minute. It seems like it's becoming more and more unavoidable, you know, that people see it that way.
Yeah, I think you've raised a really important point about the role of social media. I do have to say, though, that I mean, The Guardian, you know, and a number of other papers, including, you know, Ben Hubbard of the New York Times, did really, really outstanding work from Gaza, talking about the human costs on the ground. But I do think, yeah, social media clearly played a role, you know, both the conventional media and social media did, you know, a really important job in a number of the most horrific individual stories, you know, the four little boys who were killed on the beach, basically slaughtered, by incoming Israeli missiles from the sea. It was apparent that they were targeted, and, you know, the Guardian and the New York Times wrote important pieces on that. But I also think you're right. Social media, I mean, there was an NBC reporter, who's an Arab American or maybe he was Egyptian. I can't remember, a reporter who was telling the truth, for NBC, and they were going to fire him, and social media basically helped force NBC to retain him. So, I think that there is that issue, especially for the younger people, the millennials, and this is maybe why, you know, some of them are in polls show more sympathy toward the Palestinians and less toward Israel, because they're not going through the traditional filters and the gatekeepers who, you know, are the arbiters of opinion. They're seeing when they see, you know, children dying on the beach, they don't really need to have that explained to them.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I'll let you go, Sandy, but I sure appreciate you coming back on the show to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, it's always good to talk to you, Scott, and thanks for your interest.
All right, y'all. That is Sandy Tolan. You can find him at tomdispatch.com with this one, The Death of the Two-State Solution, a.k.a. Throwing in the Towel. His books are The Lemon Tree and Children of the Stone, about music schools in the West Bank. He is a professor at the Annenberg School for Journalism and Communication at USC. That's Scott Horton's show. Thanks, y'all, very much for listening. Check out the new thing, man, libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show for the archives and, you know, just the first part. For the rest of the site there, it's the brand new institute. I'm the managing director of it. Welcome to it, libertarianinstitute.org. And we'll see y'all next time. Thanks.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1-ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.